Welcome to Half Hour of Heterodoxy, featuring conversations with scholars and authors and ideas from diverse perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Tony McAleer is my guest on today's episode. He's the author of the new book, The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist's Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. He's the co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to help people leave hate groups and to counter hate on social media without censorship. He's based out of Vancouver, British Columbia. Hi, Tony. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So your book comes out this month. We're recording this in November 2019. Tell me about why you chose to write this book now.
That's a great question, because I'm an incredible procrastinator sometimes, and I've been meaning to write a book since about 2007, when I started doing the counseling work and started doing the healing work to understand how and why I got in, and to understand the process of returning to humanity and connecting with my own humanity. I thought I was in a place to write that in 2007, 2008, but I'm glad I didn't, because the story was really just beginning. And so I continued to do that counseling work, and I co-founded Life After Hate in 2011, which opened a whole other avenue that I wouldn't have been able to write about had I written it earlier. And that avenue takes me to the work of helping other people who are where I once was leave these movements behind, and to learn academically the theories around it. And most importantly, it gave me a platform and an opportunity to go back to the communities I had once harmed, and in a restorative way to create healing for those communities and for myself. That's the byproduct. But, I've done a lot of that. I've gone back to the Jewish community. I did a trip to Auschwitz in the last 2 years to confront myself and who I used to be in terms of my Holocaust denial. And so I feel that this cycle of the journey is complete, and I think the world really needs something hopeful to read. So I'm really glad that I waited until now. I think now is the perfect time. Now is when it's needed most, and now is when the story is the most complete. If I'd have written it in 2007, it would be a lot like other books written by farmers, where here's what I did in the movement. I kind of get out near the end. When I leave the movement in the book, it's the middle of the book. And the whole back end of the book is exploring forgiveness, compassion, radical compassion, atonement, making amends, and giving back to the communities I once harmed.
And you joined a white supremacist group in your teen years, and a big chunk of the book, and you talk about this in interviews too, is what it is that attracts young men, young white men, to these groups and how they're retained. So describe what your ideas are there.
Well, it's, it's not so much the ideology itself, but what comes with the ideology. And that's acceptance, community, brotherhood, a sense of purpose, a sense of, joining a great cause greater than yourself. And you go from zero to hero, and go from, not to be overly generalizing, sitting in your mom's basement playing video games to being at the vanguard of this great heroic struggle to save the white race from genocide. So there's, and you see similar things when you look at the histories of people that joined ISIS, and that's it. Same zero to hero piece. And also comes with it is notoriety, and it becomes an outlet for unresolved anger. I got power when I felt powerless, and it was all about me and my narcissism and my ego, and that whole movement is full of narcissism and ego, and I was right at home there.
And you talk about one of the reasons you felt powerless was in the Catholic school you went to, the administrators were extremely strict and there was corporal punishment, which made you feel powerless. Do you feel like actually having healthy religious institutions in places where children aren't treated that way is a way to build communities where young men don't feel like they need to join some alternative white supremacist group?
I'm not opposed to religious schools at all. And I'm glad corporal punishment is a thing of the past. And, you know, there's many ways to get to that place of, being a healthy young man. And if religion is part of that, that's fine with me. I'm not very religious. I'm more spiritual than religious.
Yeah. It's a common description nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I think my school beat the Catholicism out of me. So,
yeah.
But you know, there's a variety of ways to get that. I mean, I say I could have got all of that attention, acceptance, approval, feel of power, confidence, all of that from being captain of the football team, but I wasn't a jock. And sometimes there's often a bit of serendipity involved in that you just meet the wrong person at the wrong time, or you're exposed to the wrong thing at the wrong time, and it just feels so right. But if you got exposed to something else that's maybe healthier, that feels so right, you could have taken you in a different direction. So there's an element of sort of chance encounter that's involved. But the analogy I like to use is, have you ever gone to the grocery store when you're feeling really hungry? You notice you make different choices, you know, from the center part of the grocery store.
Right.
Nothing forces you to put the bag of cookies or the box of chips in your cart. We have a choice to do that, but you know, I don't blame anything on my childhood. Everything I did, I chose to do, but I share those things to understand the lens through which I made those choices. And I went out into the world emotionally hungry and made horrible choices for myself and other people that provided a fleeting moment of satisfaction or relief from what was going on inside, but utterly toxic and poisonous to everyone around me.
And I brought up the Catholic education part because I wanted to talk a bit about what educators can do. I was actually raised Catholic myself, and I'm also not a practicing Catholic anymore. I went to a Jesuit school where actually, surprisingly, it was the priests who were okay. It was the other teachers who were a little more into corporal punishment. So I had a better impression of the priests at that school. But a lot of people who listen to our podcast are educators, more at the college level. But if you are an educator, how can you recognize if maybe a student of yours feels a sense of toxic shame about who they are or feels powerless? And what can you do to show compassion? I mean, often education is like this mass production process where you could have 100 students in a class. So there's not much you can do about that. But when you do have some control, what do you suggest educators do?
Well, I think we have to park our judgment, right? We can judge an ideology, we can judge an activity, but we got to make sure we don't slip into judging the human being, which seems to be so rampant in the society. And the way we do that is we stay curious. We try to understand why, how, rather than just you're wearing that baseball cap, you know, you're evil and I want nothing to do with you. You know, everyone has a story. Everyone has life events, which they don't control our destiny, but they certainly influence our destiny. And so when I sit down with someone in that situation, it's, you know, it's listening. You know, people, I think we've lost the art of listening. And, you know, dialogue isn't just waiting for your turn to talk. It's right. It's listening. And when we can listen to someone in a non-judgmental way, we can judge the ideology. We can judge the activity, but we don't judge the human being. And when people feel that they can be heard for the first time in a space that's safe, often the walls come down and you know, there's a human being inside there, but it's hard to see with all the armor and all the shields and the masks that they're wearing. And I admit, you know, it's really hard to listen to some ideas and thoughts that are abhorrent, you know, that are assault on my values. But if I'm going to be of service to that person, I have to, you know, hold my nose and sit through it to get to what's on the other side. Because it's whatever you think it's about, it's not about immigration, or it's not about the wall. It's not about any of that. It's about stuff going on much, much deeper. And these young people, they often have a very legitimate grievance. It's where they go as the solution to their grievance that's completely bonkers. So we just need to remember that, and remember the humanity that exists in everyone, no matter how inhumane they behave or talk.
And you talk about the group that you now, that you co-founded and that you now are on the board of directors of. And one of the things they do is try to systematically get people to leave white supremacist groups. What kind of research are you doing on what's effective and what's not effective?
We've got Pete Simi on our board, who's one of the top academics that study the violent far right. And we do participate in research studies. The current study we're working on is in the online space. But previously, we did an NIJ research grant, and we helped with the research. We gave them 48 people to interview. And 16 of them were women. It was the largest sample of female violent extremists. And they went through full 8-hour life inventory interviews to help understand how they, as a data set, how they got in and what were the common factors in them leaving. And study after study after study, University of Maryland has done a study with their studies of terrorism and responses to terrorism. The number one correlated factor in the history of someone joining a violent extremist group is childhood trauma. And that's just physical and sexual trauma. We get into the more less visible traumas, the emotional traumas, abandonment, neglect, divorce, those kind of things. The numbers are even higher. And when we can track, you know, how they left or what was the intervention that happened randomly or on purpose in their lives that changed their trajectory, you know, often, you know, compassion is at the core of that. In the Life After Hate, we use evidence-based counseling practices. So we know it works in other fields. It's not a unique field. It has some unique elements to it. There needs to be a bit of training, like, you know, cultural competency around it, you know, like you would have around working with gangs or domestic violence or drug and alcohol addiction. There's, you know, specific trainings, but traditional counseling practices work perfectly fine in this space. So the hard thing is to track is, you know, it's hard to track what doesn't happen, you know. Do the people go back or don't they go back? Or what did you prevent by helping? That's always much more difficult. But since Charlottesville, we've had over 300 people reach out to us. Half of those are individuals and the other half are families worried about a loved one. And we've got a great executive director, Sammy Rangel, who's Masters of Social Work, 18 years counseling experience, and he has his own story that would be a great interview for you, coming from a Latino gang background, and he rose quite high up, was one of Wisconsin's most violent inmates and spent 2 years in the basement in the hole, chained to a metal slab and, you know, hosed down because he couldn't go to the bathroom. He was chained up. He was that bad. But has had a remarkable turnaround and his social work insights and experience have been invaluable. We've incorporated the social work code of ethics. We also hired Robert Orell from Sweden, who ran Exit Sweden for 14 years, and he's trained in cognitive behavior therapy. And we're now training other practitioners, whether it be law enforcement, social workers, or mental health people, to give them that cultural competency to understand the space, and then to give them a nuanced version of motivational interviewing combined with trauma-informed care to work on top of whatever modality of therapy that they're using, mm-hmm. to make them so that they can engage with these people with the highest chance of success.
When you use cognitive behavioral therapy, that's a form of therapy that's built around identifying negative distortions that you're placing on the world. How does that apply here?
Well, I'm not a cognitive behavioral therapist, but you know, there is very much a distorted negative worldview at play. That's the whole ideology is negatively distorted. And with, you know, with the ego is always looking for evidence of what it believes to be true. There's no shortage of evidence to reinforce those worldviews. And I think we also have to look at, you know, the source. You know, we go back to toxic shame. That's a negative self view. Toxic shame is the lie we hide from ourselves and the lie we hide from the world that resides deep in our subconscious self-identity belief system, that we're less than whole, we're not good enough, we're unlovable, not pretty enough, not smart enough, and we live our lives in reaction to that. And I think, you know, part of it is correcting and healing those lies. And the ego goes to extraordinary lengths to not, you know, to hide that toxic shame from the rest of the world. And, you know, the way that I did it by numbing the pain, you know, with alcohol, but I also projected and adopted an ideology that told me I was greater than, you know, what's the opposite of shame? Pride, proud boys, a white pride. I'm proud of my race.
I suppose one of the other negative distortions might be that non-white people are out to get white people and white people need to defend themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole white genocide narrative, that there's an existential threat and whites are going to be a minority and it's the end of civilization. And, you know, or Jews are this sort of demonic hive mind of people controlling entertainment and finance out to destroy the white race through racial intermarriage, homosexuality, drugs. And, you know, it's nonsense, but I believe that the level to which we dehumanize other human beings is a mere reflection of our own internal disconnection and dehumanization. And when we can repair, the internal piece, when we can repair that toxic shame and connect to our own humanity, we can connect to the humanity in other people. So we can often go inside to change that outside distortion and narrative.
Right. And you do talk about how your interest in Buddhism was sparked around the time you were moving away from the movement too, and you bought your mother a book called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian, and then you went on a meditation retreat as well. Tell me about how that interest was sparked and how that changed you.
Well, it was through a friend, a mutual friend, and he was a leader in the movement as well. His name was George Birdie. He was the founder of Resistance Records and lead singer of the band Rahoa, which is notoriously famous. Rahoa meaning racial holy war. And he and I sort of talked each other out of the movement over the years. We were both bright middle class kids, private school educated, and all of that. So we, compared to the people around us, the typical people around us, we were intellectually quite a few steps above, you know, and read more books than everybody else. And so we always had these conversations, both when we were deeply involved in the movement, but also on the way out. And he married an Indian woman, and so we, you know, as we were both leaving, we we both stayed in touch. And I think she introduced him to Eastern mysticism, and he introduced it to me, and flew out to Vancouver so we could drive 2 hours to go to my introduction to meditation was a 10-day Vipassana silent meditation.
Right. You described that in the book.
People say, that was your first meditation? And I was like, yeah, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But it was one of the most difficult things I've ever done, but one of the most profound things that I had ever done. And that was the first time that I really started this internal inquiry to look inside of me. Everything up until then was what's going on outside of me. And everything external is to blame for what's happening to me. And this began the journey of self-discovery and internal reflection and eventually the healing work to repair everything inside. And as I did that, my worldview changed. And, I'm a big believer, heal the self, heal the world.
Yeah. And you talk about compassion a lot. It's on your website too. It's featured prominently. That's part of your mission, is using compassion. Given the options out there, how do you persuade people that the compassionate strategy, in terms of persuasion, how do you persuade people that compassion is the best strategy here?
Well, so we look, if we're talking about other people looking at that population, I ask them, how's doxing people working? How is calling them out, calling them names, shaming them, ridiculing, dehumanizing them? How is that working? It's not. It's actually contributing to the problem. It's actually making it worse. I can point to hundreds of people that we've helped with compassion that have come back and reclaimed their humanity, and many of them living productive, engaged lives in their communities, compassionate lives to the benefit of their communities. I've got results. I don't know if anyone can show me the results that punching a Nazi, did punching Richard Spencer change Richard Spencer? No, it emboldened him. So it's, we have to, in our engagement of the people on the far right and the violent far right, we have to ask ourselves the question before we're going to consider an action is, what's our intention? If the intention is to be right and to feel good about yourself, go ahead, scream, throw things at them, do whatever you want. If your intention is to change them, then we have to look at what works and what doesn't. And compassion clearly works, but the greatest misunderstanding about compassion is that it's weak, or forgiveness, that it's weak, and it has to be accompanied by healthy boundaries and consequences. Compassion, forgiveness does not give a pass to someone because they've got mommy daddy issues or something like that. Compassion is seeing the humanity within that person. And it's important that we do call people out, but we also have to remember that we have to call people in as well. And so that the compassion with the healthy boundaries is an incredibly powerful piece. If you punch me in the face and I forgive you, and then you punch me in the face again and I forgive you again, that's not forgiveness. That healthy boundaries piece, it's not forgiveness. Right. It is weak. But in a society, law enforcement is tasked with the healthy boundaries and consequences. And when I think of these people, I think of wounded 4-year-old children inside grown men's bodies having a temper tantrum. But I'm also mindful of the fact that there's nothing more dangerous in this world than a wounded 4-year-old child having a temper tantrum in a grown man's body.
Right. And you do talk about an interesting strategy you have on Twitter. So describe that strategy to get people to stop retweeting hate speech tweets.
Yeah, that's the We Counter Hate campaign, wecounterhate.com. And again, it's sort of this out-of-the-box thinking. And it was based on there's a group that does been around much longer than we have called Exit Germany. And what they did is they have the, I can't remember what they call it, but basically there's this followers of Rudolf Hess, the Nazi, one of the Nazi top guys in World War II. He's buried in this town, and they have a march every year through this town. And they Exit Germany set up a walkathon. And so for every kilometer the Nazis march, they raise money to fight racism. Mm-hmm. So the Nazis are marching, the townspeople come out and give them water bottles and bananas to encourage them to walk further so that they can raise money to, so they, it becomes self-defeating.
Right.
So we teamed up with a creative group out of Seattle called Possible. And, you know, we gave them the keywords. We worked with them on the languaging of it, and they provided all the technical expertise. And, you know, Twitter is, you know, such a toxic place. And there's more hateful tweets on Twitter than Game of Thrones, than Major League Baseball, than all of these different categories, which are super popular. But the hateful tweets are more. And so what, when someone types a hateful tweet in, we have this AI that we were training. It recognizes the tweet. It goes to a human to flag it, and it says, is this a hateful tweet or not? And it gets a thumbs up, a thumbs down. When it's a hateful tweet, the AI then posts a message, a reply to the tweet, and says, you know, if you reply to this, if you retweet this tweet, we're going to donate $1 to Life After Hate. And what we found immediately was a 65% reduction in retweets. 18% of the time that the original tweet was deleted by the author. And a side effect of it is 30% of the time Twitter investigated the account. And so it was a way of, how do we reduce this without censorship? You know, because we don't want to, the answer isn't to censor everything so nothing bad happens. The idea is to try and change behavior and clean things up. But it was remarkable. And I think there's, you know, there's the impersonal nature of the internet, and that we stand there thinking that we're anonymous when we post stuff, and we don't know the people on the other end. But, you know, what this kind of does is tap on you on the shoulder and say, well, you know, I saw you posted that. And, you know, if you're going to retweet that, or, you know, we're watching, this AI is watching, and it that seems to have changed behavior. And I know a professor out of Yale was doing similar experiments with chatbots, where people would write toxic things, and the chatbot would say, just say, hey, you know, that's a human being on the other side of that comment. And I think over the course of a month or so, repeatedly doing that to target people, reduce their hateful tweets by 50%. So, you know, the answer isn't to suppress behavior. The answer is to change it.
Right. That's a useful strategy. I've seen that strategy in a couple of other places. You mentioned the march in Germany, and I hadn't heard of that, but I've heard of similar approaches. And when it comes to your funding, I know the Obama administration promised your group about $400,000, and this was a story in the national news. The Trump Department of Homeland Security decided to drop that funding. Do you know why it was dropped and whether you might eventually get it?
Well, the official reason why we were told it was dropped is that because we weren't working with law enforcement, you know, they changed the parameters by which everything was scored, that kind of thing. And, you know, there's lots of speculation. It's because we were working with white supremacists. I don't know that that's the case. But, you know, in a way, it was the best thing that ever happened to us, because, you know, over 10,000 donors gave us close to $800,000 in small donations in the 3 or 4 months after Charlottesville. And so, thank you for cutting our funding. We got twice as much as we asked for. It's funny how the universe works that way.
That is funny. What do you think? I'll close with this. What do you think about the federal government and the Canadian government's response at the moment? Do you think in general it's a functional response and they're aware of the threat?
I don't think in the past they've been healthy, but I think where they're going with it now is much more healthy. And, you know, I think now that they're taking homegrown domestic violent extremism seriously, before I think they were overly focused on, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda inspired threats, ignoring the domestic threat. And I think now they're taking the domestic threat very seriously. Canada is, they've been really slow to put a proper response in place. But I know what they're doing, and they're just being very well thought and methodical about what they do. So I anticipate when they do stuff, it will be done properly and done right, and it will be well researched. And so it's, I think too often governments knee jerk react and try to come out with a popular solution that actually doesn't work or isn't, you know, isn't functional. Canada's taking its time a little bit, but I anticipate they will come out with a great response, because I know the people that are thinking through it all.
Great. Well, Tony, thank you for joining us on the show. I really appreciate you taking your time to do this.
Thank you for having me.
Tony's book, The Cure for Hate, was published earlier this month and is available in bookstores everywhere. You can learn more about Life After Hate at lifeafterhate.org. And you can follow Tony on Twitter at McAleer. That's spelled McAleer. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, because it helps other people find out about the show. You can reach me at podcast@heterodoxacademy.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at ChrisMartin76. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDX Academy, and on Facebook.